So we've got about 45 minutes. What we'll do is Ellen and I will have a chat, and then in the last 20 minutes, we'll open it up to some questions from the audience. Do you have a question to start with?
Yeah, why are we here?
We planned that. We rehearsed that bit.
Let everyone know about what some of the background to this chat.
Yeah, okay. So Ellen and I were both recipients of the Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Novelist of the Year Award last year. And it was actually an unprecedented moment in Australian literary award culture, because it was the first literary award where it was not a multicultural category, but all the winners, who including Ellen and I, were Omar Musa, Maxine Benaba Clark, and Alice Pung. All the winners were people from Indigenous or migrant background. And we received our award at the Wharf in Sydney for the Sydney Writers Festival. And we were sitting in the front row of a 300-seater theatre. And just before Ellen and I got up to get our award, I tapped Ellen on the shoulder and I said, "Look behind you." And, you know, she turned around and she gasped, because it was just 300 white faces. In fact, the room was kind of like these black boxes. It's like, it was like it was glowing, you know. you know, like since then, Ellen and I have been talking about collaborating with each other. I was really keen to bring her out to Western Sydney for a week, which has taken a year and a half to make happen. And it's a great pleasure right now to tap you on the shoulder, that I can't reach that far, but to say, look at this audience. This is our community, and this is what we mean when we talk about Western Sydney. So now, just quickly to talk about the dialogue. The thing is that I think Arab Australian Muslim communities and Indigenous communities, what we share in the kind of mainstream discourse is that we're both, our cultural groups are the groups that seem to kind of receive. It's always been like that for Indigenous people, but for Arab Australians, particularly after 9/11, the most demonizing attention in mainstream news. And that debate and that discussion, it's always being facilitated by white people. And I use the term white here based on the research of Ghassan Haj, who defines whiteness as the fantasy position of cultural dominance born out of European expansion. And he talks about it as a fantasy, that there's this kind of imaginary facilitator of the space. And that facilitator usually facilitates the dialogue for Arab Australian Muslims, and it facilitates the dialogue for Indigenous people. And so why I wanted to bring us together is because it was only a matter of time before first Australians and new Australians came to the realization that we can cut that middle person out and we can have a direct discussion with one another. And there are some extremely important things we have to talk about, which use kind of similar rhetoric to the way One Nation talk about us. We have to ask ourselves, for example, like they ask about us, we have to ask ourselves, are white people still good for Australia? And we have to ask ourselves things like, do we need to create an assimilation program to help white people ease into the multicultural reality? So that's why we're here. Now, I have a question for Ellen. And, you know, we're going to talk about the writing we read. I think we have a responsibility to talk about what we read to you. But I actually have a question before that. One of the hardest things we've been going through this week, because Ellen's been here doing events with us all week, a masterclass with some writers from Sweatshop, a Women of Colour workshop on Wednesday night. Last night she presented at Parramatta for an event called Studio Stories. She even talked to the ABC. But you know, what's been coming up a lot for our writers, who are all from non-English speaking backgrounds, without any exceptions, is at the moment, I think because it's an exclusively culturally and linguistically diverse group, what's been going on is our writers have kind of started fighting, instead of talking about, the issues of things like white supremacy and white privilege, we've started kind of feuding and talking about whether we even have a right to talk about each other's stories. And we promoted this event as Black and Lebo, a public dialogue. And what I've been struggling with all week is how we have this dialogue. That's my question to you.
Really? How do we have this dialogue about minority groups writing about other minority groups, or what's the question?
Yeah, well, I'll explain my question a little bit further. But I think what's come out in the last week, and we can unpack this a bit more with the group, but it seems to me like it's kind of even problematic for us to even be allowed to talk to each other at the moment. And this is in the kind of climate of the reemergence of One Nation and quite a conservative colonial type writer who came to the Brisbane Writers Festival and said, you know, we white people should be allowed to write whatever we want. And in that climate, there's kind of been a sensitivity about even cultural exchange. And so my question is, how do we even have this discussion right now?
Well, I think this is on our own agenda. You know, this is not a reaction to the Lionel Shriver speech or any of that discussion that's come out of it. This is a discussion. There's something pure about it, right? Because we've just read from our works, and we're going to talk about our works, and we're not going to. Of course, we've had many discussions, and I've talked to many different writers over the last week, and I think we really just it's the most essential thing is that writers, First Nation writers, and migrant writers have to tell their stories and kind of counter the telling of other people of their own stories and of their own identities and who they can be, and so I think, you know, I talk to a lot of young people about it, and I just say, you know, just get it on the page, just focus your energy on your own work without anyone else's agenda, without it can be a reaction to that. But really just, you know, I think, you know, for me, when I first read the works, being at school and reading books only by white writers, you know, and having the education very much from a white perspective, and how, you know, how that was, what that experience was like for me, and then to read the works for the first time of, you know, Ujiru Nunakul and Kevin Gilbert, and I was like, you know, wow, you know, I didn't realize that was part of a reality. I didn't realize that, you know, our mob were writing books as well, you know, as well as contributing to public life in all of the ways that I knew that we were, and that for me, that changed something. And I think every non-white writer has that experience too when they read a book by someone that they can identify with. I think we just need to focus the attention on our work, on our writing.
Great, thank you. So that's a good entry into let's focus on our work. Let me ask you about your work, what you read to us today.
Yeah, I read, I wanted to give a little bit of like a taste of like, of what, you know, comfort food's about, which like is about like really three things, you know. It's about the times that I'm experiencing, you know, that there was a poem about Goodsy, you know, that or those, a lot of things were unraveling in that year that I wrote this book that are very, you know, very, very fresh, you know, very, I was really kind of capturing my experiences at the time and my thoughts. It's about family. So acknowledging the impact that my family members have on me and my life and the contributions that they've made, and And it's also about land. It's about Southeast Queensland. It's very specific, as was my previous book, Hidden Light. And so I think those poems reflected each of those aspects. And what about you? How did you choose? Where did you choose to? I understand this is an extract.
It's an extract from my new book, The Lebs. And, you know, the people who are close to me know that I've spent months thinking about whether I wanted to read this piece of writing. Because it's humiliating. And I don't even think, you know, some people in the audience probably know better than others how humiliating it actually is. My wife's in the audience and my younger sisters. But, you know, the reason why I read it is because we promoted this event as a public dialogue in which we would discuss the intersections between race, faith, class, gender, and sexuality. And, you know, I think that story, if you listen to it, you could easily fall into the trap of pigeonholing it in the kind of identity that you usually suffer with, you know. You say it's about gender. It's about patriarchy, sexism, misogyny. You say it's about race. You know, you say it's about Arab Australian Muslim men interacting with members of the dominant culture. Or you say it's about class. It's about poor people from the western suburbs of Sydney. But, you know, we promoted the event as a discussion about the intersections, and it's, to me, about all those things. It's about the intersections between class, race, and gender. And as a young Arab Australian Muslim man growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney, that was the space that we were dealing with and that we were creating. And you know, one of the reasons this is such an intellectually frustrating experience, and this week really amplified it because of the amount of people who started speaking out about how angry they are about how the way they're being treated, you know, because of some kind of broader social context that they're within. You know, discussions about racism, sexism, homophobia. We kind of pretend like we're trapped in one space, like we're either completely oppressed or we're completely empowered. But just thinking about the way my Anglo-Australian wife and I move in and out of our spaces, you know, she walks down the street on the main road. It doesn't really matter what she's wearing, what she looks like. Guaranteed some jerk is going to call her wolf whistle or call her a slut or something like that. And that's an experience that I as a man don't know about. And I've never experienced that. But, you know, when we got on an aeroplane and we went to New York City, they let her go through and they detained me and spent 2 hours interrogating me. And so we're moving in and out of our privileges. We're constantly exchanging our privileges and our disadvantages as we move in and out of space. And, you know, cultural theorists like bell hooks, who's a black feminist social activist, she says, you know, the full embodiment of the problem is a thing called imperialist white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. Now, who in the room is an imperialist white supremacist capitalist patriarch, right? No one. Most of us are, you know, negotiating one disadvantage against one privilege as we move through certain spaces. And I wanted to demonstrate that through this work.
Yeah.
I think it's my turn to ask you a question. Unless you have something to add.
Oh, I just wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about, you know, this novel
that does open up an opportunity for me to ask you the question I wanted to ask you. Yeah. Because I'm interested in these terms, you know, and I will talk about the title of my book, The Lebs. And actually, the way we promoted this event is Lebo and black. And so the question I had for you is, you know, in Australia, like race politics and the identities of race are so complex that the word black doesn't literally mean black or black skin, right? So I wanted to ask you, how do we define these categories that we've promoted our banner under? What does black mean? What does it mean to be black in Australia today?
Yeah, I mean, it would mean something else in all different parts of Australia too, you know, in all different circles. Yeah, for me, I identify with the term black and black fellow in my in, you know, in my community in Southeast Queensland, we also talk about ourselves as Māoris and Gurīs. We prefer when people acknowledge the group that we're from. So, you know, I introduce myself if I meet a Māori and I haven't met them before, I'll introduce myself as a Malanjali woman from Bow Desert, and they'll introduce themselves, you know, as Bundjalung, or, you know, from where they're from, and, you know, we'll trace our families and we'll see who we have in common. So that's a little bit of the way that we map our space in Southeast Queensland, and then using black as well to talk about other groups in Australia as well who identify as black, not just Aboriginal people. And then, of course, it's very different in other countries as well. And I really think it's, you know, it's individual, like how we feel about what we're called and what we call ourselves. It's very individual, and that's why it's such a complex and it's a bit of a minefield as well. You know, when we do use these words, but when they come from ourselves, that's a much different thing than when it comes from an outsider. And so, what about you when you use lebo, when you use leb?
I'll answer it, but I'm gonna ride the momentum of what you're saying. I'm just gonna build on the question, and then I'll answer your question. But so then, what is and how do you define black literature in Australia? And what literature inspires you as an Aboriginal reader? And what literature would you recommend? What black literature would you recommend to non-Indigenous people?
Yeah, personally, I use black literature to talk about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander literature. I'll talk about black writing in that way. And the writers that have been really influential to me, the contemporary writers. As going back to, I mentioned Ujiru Nunakul and Uncle Kevin Gilbert and those writers who were, you know, the warriors, writers, activists who, you know, really have led the way. The writers that I that are still living and writing, Uncle Tony Birch, Aunty Melissa Lukashenko, I'm sure some of you are familiar with their work. They're really they're fantastic writers. Writing Uncle Tony's from Melbourne, and Aunty Melissa's from Northern New South Wales, Queensland. So they're both writing about a specific place and identity. But really, it's a national literature. You know, these writers are really contributing to this whole country and how we talk about particular issues, how we talk about environmental change, we talk about violence, how we talk about language, and they're incredible writers. And then I work with writers all the time that are from from different levels of experience and different levels of publication, and these writers are from all over Australia, and black writing incorporates a lot of different genres. So, you know, poetry has been very important to our people, as memoir has as well. But you know, this contemporary space is opening it up to allow us space to write in any genre. So you have Aboriginal writers writing commercial fiction and horror and science fiction, and it's really diverse.
Thank you. I'll answer your question now. Yeah. The term Leb in a literal way is short for the term Lebanese, but the title of my new book and the theme of my doctoral research on this identity, the Leb. Is specifically for me talking about young men from the western suburbs of Arab-Australian, primarily Muslim background. And then people who identified with that category. So my experience growing up was that, you know, Osama, the Indonesian, when girls asked him what was his background, he'd say, I'm a Leb. You know, and I had similar experiences with people who were from Turkish background. There were even some examples where Greeks and Italians started calling themselves Lebs in our social group. I'm Leb. Just like the way Arab Australians started calling themselves Wogs. And what I discovered was that the term Leb, it became a new identity. And what I, you know, I'm talking about communities like Turkish, Indonesian. I mean, they, you know, they're quite separate from the Arab identity. But even, you know, Jordanians, Syrians, Palestinians, they just became all Lebs, particularly in the climate of the 2000 gang rapes, the September 11 attacks on New York City. You know, the 2005 Cronulla riots. I mean, who are you talking about when you're screaming, fuck off Lebs? Like 500 Anglo-Australians were chanting this. And that is, seemed to include Bangladeshis on a train, you know, who they nearly killed, by the way. So I'm fascinated in this identity. And what all the research has shown is that it's a hybrid identity. It's a unique formation, which is Australian, regardless of whether we like that or not. And there are particular elements in it, which Gus and Harsh talks about, which I think are fascinating. You know, elements of kind of working class, underclass masculinity that you find among all cultural groups in the western suburbs of Sydney. And then elements of Arabness and Lebaneseness, but none that you would find in the Middle East unless you met Arab Australians in the Middle East. And then, which was the most fascinating to me, is the adoption of, you know, African-American and Latino subaltern popular culture, you know, in the way they were dressing, talking, interacting with one another. And this kind of hybrid identity is what we started to call the Leb. And I'll just tell you one more thing in this exchange, you know, the discussion between Black and Lebo is, you know, yesterday when we were being interviewed by Lola from Koori Radio, she was telling me about this Lebanese rapper, you know, who she caught on a beach, and in his rap lyrics, he was constantly using the word nigger. And she tapped him on the shoulder and said, you can't say that, you know? And then he goes, I'm an Arab. And then she's like, then you got to say sand nigger, you know? But that is the kind of hybridity that I think is revealing itself among this marginalized group. And I think it's revealed itself as a response, as a throwback to marginalization. And so that's what I mean when I say the Leb. And that's what my book is about. It's about this group of young men.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about locality and place, because it's something that's often understood and talked about, is First Nations writers' connection to place. But what about you? What's your experience and your method of it on the page? And also as a secondary question to that, do you feel, would you write about a Lebanese Australian living somewhere else than Sydney? Do you feel like that you could do that or want to do that?
Yeah, so, you know, it's fascinating that in the beginning, the origins of what we call Sweatshop today, and particularly through the work of the publications of Giramondo, the Western Sydney publications, there was an emphasis in the original model on writing about Western Sydney. You know, it was a kind of a empty space for literature where there's this fascinating community that you can see before you. And, you know, it was worthy of representation. And that's kind of a very self-determined, very deliberate attempt to write about a place that we came from. But, you know, now what's happened, you know, after having been, I've been doing this now for a decade, teaching creative writing, what I'm finding, and this is going to answer your second question, what I'm finding is that it still looks like we're just emphasizing write about place, you know, but it's not really what's going on. What's going on is I have come to the conclusion that good writing is always specific and is always unique. And what bad writing is, by definition, is its lack of ability to have a unique voice, or lack of specificity, a lack of distinction about it. And in this way, bad writing is universal and good writing is subjective. And in this, so what's going on in Sweatshop is I'm not actually telling people to write about place anymore. I'm telling them to write about what they know, what they understand, and what they have a direct connection to. So it just so happens that we're a Western Sydney movement, and that reveals itself to be a lot of writing about Western Sydney. But so would I ever write about the Arab Australian experience outside of Western Sydney? No, because it doesn't belong to me. I don't have it as part of my identity. But there's one other point I want to make, a slightly controversial one, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. But, you know, this term popped up a couple of weeks ago, which has been troubling me, non-black people of colour. And, you know, originally there was this idea of like, there are people of colour and there are white people. And that's how we understand the politics of race. But now there's this kind of, and it happened during Muhammad Ali passed away, you know, there was this idea that Muhammad Ali is ours, people of colour like Arabs, he's not yours, you can't identify with him. This was the kind of debate that was unfolding. And so what a colleague of mine said to me the other day is that what migrants and refugees, you know, they want to identify with blackness in Australia, with Aboriginality. But they have to come to terms with the fact that they've benefited from colonization. And it's a difficult point for me to have to hear. I want to hear your thoughts on it. But I'll just tell you why I'm struggling with it. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm personally very privileged, very happy to be here. And I'm aware of what the consequences for the Indigenous population have been in order for me to have it. But our displacement is the result of colonization as well. And it's also the reason why the statement is bothering me is because it's completely through the lens of capitalism. When you say you're benefiting from colonization, it's saying you're benefiting primarily on the basis that you've got an education and you live in a house. You have a nice TV. All those things are true in my case. But, you know, we are still, I am living every single day with the pain of not being in the Middle East, you know. And when we get relatives who come here and bring word from the Middle East, what they're talking about is not ISIS or Hamas or Hezbollah. They're talking about my cousins who are in jail in Israel or who are dead. And that's how we're experiencing our presence here, that we also, you know, we long for a sense of home because we don't feel it here and we don't feel it in the motherland. So, but I would really like to hear your thoughts, particularly on the relationship between the refugee and the migrant and their presence on an Aboriginal country.
Well, I want to ask you a question about when you developed a consciousness of being on Aboriginal land and growing up, how, you know, you're meeting Indigenous people and how, you know, what was your feelings in growing up and what was the discussion in your home about these issues? I'd be very curious to know.
There are two times in my life that I've seen my father cry. The first time is when my grandmother passed away, when his mum passed away. You know, and he was the embodiment of masculinity to me. So when I saw him crying and shrugging at me, it terrified me. I was like, this is where my strength comes from. And now I know that it's vulnerable. But the second time I saw him cry was the 2000 Olympics. When...
Catherine Freeman?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. My dad, you know, like he's illiterate. Like, you know, he left school when he was 12. He worked his whole life, you know. He still, you know, he has a camping business where he still deals money with his wallet, you know. He makes sales with his wallet and no receipts. But he'll be happy to exchange. He'll be happy to exchange anything if there's a problem without a receipt. just in case you want to know. But you know, I was like, what? Why are you crying? I'm embarrassed. And he's like, because she's Aboriginal. And I know that that was the point where I realized that we're guests here. And do you know that it's so weird because, you know, like, why Australia? It's so unwelcoming, you know, like, we don't like guests. But it's such a big part of my culture. You know, like, it's almost a stereotype that the Arab Australians are generous to their guests. If someone knocks on your door, you let them in, you feed them, you clothe them, you know, you give them a bed, you look after them. You know?
I can say you've been a very, very good host to me.
Ellen's been staying with us. It's been an honour. It's been an honour to have you stay with us.
Kathy Freeman. I mean, what a moment. I remember that. I still, you know, because the Olympics has just recently been on, they re-show all of that footage, and you still get those goosebumps, and you still, I can. That moment is so, like, visual for me. I remember it very well. I just remember the kind of the feeling of deep pride that I had, and, you know, continued to have through watching sport. You know, how big sport is for our people, and I think talking about contributions to sport. I think, you know, you'd have a lot to say too about, you know, the idols of when you were growing up as well, being sports people.
I think what's so important is for people of colour, like, sport is a domain where, and I'm going to ask you a question, this is the last question I'm going to ask Ellen, and then we'll open it up to the audience. But, you know, sport is kind of the domain where people of colour have been able to transcend their oppression. But we're writers, you know. And at a certain point, there is a step you have to take towards saying, you know, I'm not all body, you know, and that I am a mind. Like, I am the descendant of, an intellectual history. And so can I ask you, when is that moment of you saying, I am a writer? And what does it mean to be an Aboriginal writer?
What does it mean to be an Aboriginal writer? I think I do want to say that sports people, that sport is so intellectual, particularly the sports that I'm interested in.
Why don't you tell us what they are too? What do you tell us the sports you're interested in?
Okay, well, I watch most sports. You know, it's something that is actually a little bit in opposition with writing, because if I had it my way, I wouldn't write. I would just, you know, watch sport and play sport the whole time. I enjoy watching sport that I have knowledge of and sports that I don't have knowledge of. So I don't really have a lot of personal experience with boxing, but I really enjoy watching it. I play a lot of soccer or football, as my father calls it. My dad's Dutch, so that's what we were doing as kids through my dad's influence, and my dad, you know, being married to the local club, and just spending most of our time running around and playing, and we also played tennis, and we also played footy, and most of my family are really into rugby league, and you know, we watch the games together. And you know, for me, State of Origin is always a really exciting time of the year, as are the finals this weekend and the Korean knockout. I just engage with any kind of sport, and I've always engaged with black athletes, no matter if they're Aboriginal or not. You know, I've always felt, you know, we've always kind of like adopted them. And talked about them in that way.
Talk to us about writing, about your journey as a writer, and then we'll open it up to questions.
About my journey as a writer. So yeah, as an Indigenous writer, I don't think I could have like felt like I could write until I'd read the works that I mentioned before, and then I felt that was a space for us. I grew up reading a lot of books because Mum got a job in a library when I was, you know, like, I think I was 10. And, you know, me and my brother would, and the school holidays, would go to the library, and where my mother worked, and she would just, like, leave us to, you know, to just be in a room with books. And, you know, we couldn't go outside, we couldn't kick a ball around, so, you know, we had to read. And I just completely, like, it just clicked in my head, you know, that I wanted to write just from reading. You know, my imagination soared. And when times were tough in my schooling days, I would sit and read a book, and I would live in that world. And so after uni I found out about a project that was starting up called Black and Right, and it was a project that was set up to change things up, you know, to change the writing and publishing industry, which to not only provide opportunities for First Nations writers, but to employ more people in the industry, and to really to look at Indigenous editing, to look at seeing that contribution of what an editor makes on a text, and then to even, you know, have a dream of having Aboriginal people involved in all stages, and you know, to have more of us working in the industry, because there's only a very few numbers, and Ivor will contest to that. You know, that there's not many of us that have positions in the industry, but there's you know, a very the number of writers is increasing day by day, and so I applied for this position as a trainee editor, and was mentored under Sue Abbey, who had worked on the David Unipon list, Black Australian writing list at UQP. Those who don't know about the David Unipon Award, it was an award that was set up, I think, 27 years ago now, in 88, is, you know, named after David Unipon, the man on our $50 bill, who was many different things, and one of them being a writer, and being our first published writer, although his work was published under another name. And it took a long time for that to be corrected, which is, you know, just there's just been numerous examples of our stories being taken and appropriated, and so this award has really, you know, been very influential, and so Sue Abbey, you know, being there working with the writers. Doris Pilkington, who wrote Rabbit Proof Fence, you know, the impact of that film when it came out, particularly in the US, you know, the Aussie government here freaking out, you know, with the posters that they were, you know, putting around in the US, that indicating that about the Stolen Generation here in Australia, that was at that moment, you know, and still is something that. You know, that people refuse to acknowledge that happened, and so Sue came with a lot of experience, but as a white woman, she told me the conversations that she had to have and the learning that she had to have to be able to work on these books with these writers, and she passed on a lot of knowledge to me about editing and about how. You know, how we could really, you know, just change things up by working with writers who, in many cases, felt a hesitation about the whole process, and really some had had some awful experiences where they were told to white up their work, you know, to remove references or language or to explain things more. And we were like, nah, blacken it up, you know. And so that was my exposure to working with Aboriginal writers, Torres Strait Islander writers, and I was like, all right, yeah, this is where I want to be, and I think I can give it a go myself. And having that mentorship, and you know, gave me the confidence to do so. And I think, you know, that's something that's kind of that's lacking, you know, to bring our young writers through from different backgrounds, is that they don't have that support, you know, that they don't have that access and those opportunities, that there's that mentorship that once you have it, you know, it's so profoundly empowering and important. Yeah.
What time is it? Okay, maybe we'll talk. We'll take some questions from the audience for about 10 minutes, and then we have a really special lunch prepared for you upstairs. Anyone? I don't believe it. Okay, go for it.
You know, you talk about intellectual tradition, and I'm interested to know what tradition of writers or what writers specifically have inspired you. Are there Australian Arab writers, or it seems to me you've made up your own tradition, but obviously you come from a tradition as well.
I'll answer it quickly. There is a new type of identity that I'm talking about, but I'm absolutely fascinated by oral storytelling traditions from the Arab world. A Lebanese kid from Lebanon, emailed me a couple of weeks ago and told me, he's reading my novel, and he's really excited to have found an English text. What he says is the first English text he's been able to find about Arab-Australian, about Arab, from Arab writers, that taps into the tradition of hakaweti, oral storytelling. He introduced me to the term, but he took that out from the text. I didn't, Jeremondo and I haven't promoted the work as an oral text. He was able to extract that, and it terrifies me because it reveals that there is a kind of illiteracy in Australia, that Australian audiences couldn't really pick that up. But whereas a Lebanese audience who are part of that tradition and part of that history could just find it straight away. It's hakaweti, which is quite similar to the transmission of story in indigenous history. And this is, this is a dialogue about literature, And, we've talked about ways that we can collaborate. And what I find exciting about the similarities between our cultures and our histories is that they both are transmitted, the story is transmitted orally. And I'll just name one text, one Arab text, which I think we should take quite seriously as if you don't believe it's a divine document, I don't mind, but we should take it seriously as a literary document. It's the Quran, the Muslim holy book. The word Quran means recite. And the Prophet Muhammad recited the Quran. It was orally transmitted. And it's quite hard to believe, I think, for a lot of people that the words of the Quran could possibly be correct today, from 1500 years ago, and just being passed on orally. And I think that's a Eurocentric way of experiencing the world. It assumes that if you haven't written something down, which is a very, very new part of the European world, then it couldn't possibly be transmitted correctly. But I think you have to try to see this through cultures that have a developed oral storytelling tradition. And so what was really exciting for the Muslim world was they found a parchment of the Quran, just a few pages, in Birmingham, in a university in Birmingham, and they carbon dated it at 1500 years old. In fact, controversially, they reckon it could be even older than 1500 years old. But the argument that's being put forward is that the words that we recite are so close to the words that they found on this parchment that we have good reason to believe that Arabs were very good at transmitting their stories orally. Do you want to add anything from your cultural tradition or perspective?
I think that, you know, the stories that I've been surrounded with since I was young, yeah, they're oral stories, you know, it's a very unexpected, you know, it's always, you always find out something really interesting when you least expect it, you know, and that's been my kind of experience growing up with uncles and aunties and them, you know, telling me things at particular moments, you know, that I think have been all part of a plan, you know, in terms of a stage kind of understanding for me about, you know, who I am and where we've come from and an understanding of the place, you know, that we live in, you know, in specifically coming from the scenic Brim, but living and moving all over Southeast Queensland. And so, you know, this place is in front of me and is always it's always the front of my mind when I sit down to write. I wanted to, and we probably have some more questions, but in your talking about your book and people's, you know, reactions to it and saying, you know, that it's a unique work, and I'm sure there was a lot of, like, momentum for you to get this on the page when you started, but with the second work, is that different for you? You know, do you feel like a lot of kind of energy, like for me, a lot, you know, to write the stories of young queer Māori women into my book, you know, like for me, that, you know, this is unique. This is the first time I've seen these voices in a book. You know, this is very specific. And so, you know, once that you write that book, you know, like, you know, what's next?
I really don't know what's next. You know, I mean, for me, after the Lebs, I want to tell a love story, you know. I mean, I just telling a story about a teenage boy who is in a space, you know, in a kind of a marginalized space where in the news every night you're hearing about gang rapists and you're hearing about terrorists and you're hearing about drug dealers and drive-by shooters, you know, and then on the inside, you're kind of killing each other, you know, like the young men at Punchable Boys, there's a stabbing every couple of weeks, you know. And then their relationship to women in particular and the devastation that was kind of creating for those women, but also for them, like what the implications of that were for them as they moved towards becoming adults, you know, and how do you come out of it? Like, how do you get educated and end that cycle? So I want to, you know, I kind of wrote the Lebs because I just need to get away from it because it's the kind of humiliating story that I have to tell about who we were. But what I want to do next is I want to talk about who we are now, you know, and what it takes to be that. Should we take one or two more questions? We've got, yeah. What's your name?
Aisha.
Aisha?
I wanted to ask about the hybrid identity you were talking about because I work with a lot of different people and I've noticed it as well, and I wanted to know why it's with the Lebs and if it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing.
I need to unpack the question a bit more. Firstly, I don't think it is unique to Lebs. No, I mean, I think that's one hybrid identity that emerged.
Well, in the community, why do you think?
Oh, why is it the word Leb?
Yeah, like,
yeah. Well, I think it was the biggest population.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really simple why. I think they were the dominant Arab Australian Muslim group in the western suburbs, you know. So the kind of reason that it became a subculture for all these other cultural groups to identify with is really clear. Though there might be some other explanations. The question of whether it's a good or bad thing, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gorgeous, you know. We have this tendency to talk about the other in this kind of, you know, categorized way. Like, you know, these are the Arabs and these are the Aboriginals. I use that example because that's who Ellen and I are. And these are that's who we are positioned as, and these are the Greeks, and these are the Italians, and that's how Italians behave, and that's how Vietnamese behave. And it's so much more complex than that, you know. I mean, what a wonderful thing to discover, that you are a complex creature on this earth.
Do you want to questions?
Yeah.
How do you both, in dealing with Muhammad, you're talking about the various intersections of moving between privilege and marginalisation in whatever role. In the political landscape, both of you, how do you deal with the being exotic? Being sort of, you know, how do you deal with that in your writing and in your approach and in your politics?
Would you like to answer first?
Yeah, I think so. Talking about those sort of representations, those stereotypes that are on the page, those can be countered by, you know, more of us writing and more of it coming from us. And, you know, as the numbers grow, you know, you're also not the only black fellow at a writers' festival. You know, you have peers, and you know, and I feel more comfortable too when, you know, I have brothers and sisters who are not Aboriginal but are, you know, from black and brown as well, you know, and there's more numbers of us writing and participating in this dialogue about talking about literature, but it's still, you know, it's something I actually I don't really kind of, if I spent all my time looking at how we're represented on the page by non-Indigenous writers, I don't have the time or energy to do that. It's something that I prefer to kind of move the gaze onto to our people writing and to, you know, to these new voices coming in, these really exciting work, you know, like I think like the, you know, the works of those, you know, those five writers on the Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Novelist. So that year, we all came from a non-white background, but the next year, the writers...
Both white.
I think this is... It's really hard to kind of... to get any momentum when that happens. But I'm hopeful that it is going to happen, because really publishing has a... It's white fantasy to think that we only want to hear the voices of, and you just have to kind of look around us to see all of the different dynamics of Australian life that are just not represented on the page. You know, there's a very white experience is narrow.
I just want to, you know, I don't know if being exotic is inherently problematic. You know, I think it can be problematic. And in most cases, especially from the experience of what we would call, what Toni Morrison calls the white gaze, yeah, it can be quite painful. But, you know, we can be quite exotic to each other. And I've got to tell you one story, which is fascinating to me. But, you know, yesterday Ellen and I did an interview with Koori Radio. And I, you know, I got Team Sweatshop to be really committed to setting that up. Like I said to myself, I don't, she's done interviews with the ABC, you know, with all the local papers. We've done interviews with 2SER. You know, like we've done quite a few interviews, but the one that I really pushed for Sweatshop to make happen was an interview with Koori Radio, because this was a dialogue between, you know, Aboriginal Australian writing and Arab Australian writing. And, you know, I just felt like, you know, we've got an Indigenous author visiting us and we have to talk to Koori Radio about this. And so, you know, Ellen and I went to Koori Radio and Lola, who interviewed us, just wanted to talk to me and just wanted to talk to me about being Lebanese. And in particular, she just wanted to talk about how much she loves Lebanese food, you know. You know, when we walked out, like, I was like, I'm so sorry. Like, I really wanted this to be Ellen's interview. And Ellen said, you're the exotic one in that space, you know. And it was okay. Like, it was okay. I didn't mind being that to Lola, you know. I mean, I felt great. I mean, you know, I felt like, yeah, we're talking, you know, and we're friends and we're meeting, you know, we're comforted through food, you know. And I, you know, it's okay. Should we just take one more question? I'm sorry. I know I can see you putting up your hand, but you put your hand up first. So I've got to take this question. Is that okay?
Do we have time for both, or
let's take both, yeah. and then we'll go to lunch.
So my grandparents moved here from Italy. So I'm third generation Italian, and I guess like I've lost a lot of that Italianness. Like I don't look Italian. I can't speak the dialect. My only connection to that Italianness now is that I go to Flemington Market still, like once in a while. And my parents very much pushed me from like staying in that Italian community, like because it can be. So my question is, like, how, like, the third generation person, like, how do you preserve culture while not being restricted?
Look, I'm going to answer quickly, and then we can pick up on it at lunch, because I really want to get us to lunch. But you can't, and you shouldn't try to, you know. I think you can respect tradition without being a slave to it, you know. And I think it's really important that we, as a community now, a very diverse community, get on board with this idea of hybridity. You are not Italian, you know, and you're not Australian. Like you are a complex amalgamation of so many things that come together to make you who you are. And that's the way you should want it. Can we take the last question?
Yes, Ellen, you partially answered it, but I was wondering whether you can envisage a time when you're writing beyond the urgent addressing of, you know, who you are culturally, you know, whether exotic or
Aboriginal
or Lebanese,
would
you see yourself writing from a different urgency
rather than
a different
agency than
our own?
Urgency. Urgency.
Yes.
From
addressing this, just the cultural aspect of it.
Do you want to answer, Ellen?
I'm always going to write from my personal perspective, you know, which is also my political perspective, and I'm going to write about, you know, what I see is in front of me. At the moment, I'm a little stuck because I see this year is, you know, there's a lot, there's so much. And I think Facebook doesn't help, right? Like, there's a lot of, you know, violence in this country. It's no different. And I'm very concerned about you know, a lot of different things. You know, it's very urgent, these issues, and but I'm not sure if, you know, I really sometimes question, you know, it really, what I, my perspective, you know, is my perspective, and I want to. You know, it's almost like there's too many things to write about. And I wrote Heat and Light. It's fiction, you know. It's about three generations of a family, and it's about past, present, and future. You know, there's a futuristic section in the middle of it where I'm speculating. It's a satire. You know, it's meant to kind of, it's meant to be funny in parts. You know, about what this country is going to be like in 15 years' time, and so. But you know, that time is going to soon be on us, and so it's really just want to kind of write. Right, really, from a very specific perspective on what I see, on this country, and to know that I'm not alone in doing so, and that I have many other people around me who are fighting the same fight.
Let's leave it there. The Tribe, my book, but more importantly, Ellen's books, Heat and Light and Comfort Food, are on sale. They're on special, $20 each, if you want to grab a copy. And Melinda, will you, I hope you're all hungry, will you lead everyone upstairs to where we have to go for lunch? Awesome. Thank you.